Well, away from royal births and general elections, one of the main news stories this week has come from Indonesia. Eight people convicted of drug smuggling offences were executed. Clearly, these men were guilty of serious crimes. Many reports seem to indicate, though, that at least two of them had reformed during their time in prison. Two of the eyewitnesses to their execution record that as they waited to be killed, they sang Amazing Grace together. They were still singing as they were shot. It got me thinking, really, as to what that must be like. You know, to know that you have 5 hours, 4 hours, 3 hours, 2 hours left to live. Last meetings with family members and so on. In other words, how do you face imminent death? Now, it might not be the most comfortable of questions, but I want to say that a wise person asks questions like that. I guess it's unlikely to be execution, but the reality is many of us at some point in life may face a terminal illness. That's to say, we know that life is ending. 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, just that awareness that death is coming. And often people's experience at that time from what they say is this: nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about how you face death that you know is on the way. Or perhaps for others, it's the question we dread most isn't how do I face death, but is this: how do we face the death of somebody we love? How do we face that when we know it's coming and yet they mean so much to us? Sir Walter Scott, the Scottish novelist, late 18th, early 19th century, was on his deathbed. And whilst on his deathbed, he asked his servant for the book. The book, his servant asked, you've written so many books, which book? Scott replied, the Bible, of course. For the dying man, there can be no other book. We need to hear God's words on this perspective. You see, the Bible is the book for dying men and dying women, which, if you think about it, is all of us. The Bible is the book we need. And we need it because it faces death head on. It talks about it as the last, the greatest enemy that humanity faces. And it shows us characters as they face that last enemy. And that's what I want to talk about this evening. We're actually going to consider Genesis 23 and Genesis 25 tonight. And I've deliberately merged those two chapters together. Abraham and Sarah have been our companions since January, and we've seen them living in the light of God's promises. We've seen how God promised to bless them, to give them descendants, ultimately to give them the land in which they now lived. And of course, we've seen that there have been blips on the journey, times when they got it wrong, and we'll see another example of that tonight. But generally speaking, the story has been one of a life marked by God's faithfulness to his promises and their response of faith, trust, and obedience. And it's why the title we've given to the whole series has been this: Living in the Light of God's Promises. But if I'm honest, I want to look at something slightly different tonight. Tonight is about dying in the light of God's promises. And we're going to consider Sarah's death in chapter 23 and then Abraham's death in chapter 25. Three things I want us to notice. Here's the first, and it's really mainly from chapter 23. We're going to see dying in the promised land. Dying in the promised land. So, beginning of chapter 23, Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. So at this point, Sarah has died. I guess given her age of 127, we might all say at a funeral, well, at least she had a good innings. But no matter how old she was, there was still the pain of parting. Sarah has been Abraham's companion on all his journeys, all the ups and downs of his life. She's been with him. And now she's gone. And so Abraham goes to mourn for her and to weep over her. Even for the believer, bereavement is deeply painful. But it's not actually the pain of the bereavement that's the main focus of this chapter. Believe it or not, the whole focus of Genesis chapter 23 is this question: where is Sarah going to be buried? Where is she going to be laid to rest? Because remember, Sarah and Abraham, they're away from their homelands. They're in Canaan, the promised land. But despite the fact that they're in the promised land, they still don't own any of it. They're still, if you like, visitors there. And there are no municipal burial grounds. There's no church burial sites. Where is Sarah going to be laid to rest? Now, tradition would suggest a return home, going back to the family burial site in Ur, somewhere like that, going back there. But the whole thrust of Genesis 23 is this. Abraham insists that Sarah is to be buried in Canaan. And so he goes to the Hittites and says to them, verse 4, I'm an alien and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so that I can bury my dead. And really the rest of Genesis 23 is just an extended negotiation. The Hittites reply generously, it seems, just borrow one of our tombs. You can borrow them, bury your dead there, verse 6, in one of the choicest tombs. But Abraham isn't content with that. No, he wants part of the promised land to be owned by him. If you like, he wants this to be the first sign of what will ultimately take place. Ultimately, the whole land is going to belong to his descendants. That's what God has promised. But Abraham wants Sarah's burial just to be a first sign of that, the first piece of land that Abraham and his descendants will own in the promised land. And so the negotiation continues. Abraham knows whose land he wants. He wants some of the land of Ephron, son of Zohar, Ephron the Hittite. And Ephron says, yeah, I'll give it to you. And Abraham says, no, I'm going to pay for it. And basically this goes on all the way through chapter 23 until they agree a price, 400 shekels of silver. And so listen to the conclusion of Genesis 23. Ephron's field in Machpelah, Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, was legally made over to Abraham as his property, in the presence of all the Hittites who'd come to the gate of the city. Afterwards, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and cave in it were legally made over to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. Now, you might be thinking that's a fair amount of narrative about a land deal for a burial site. And how on earth does this help us to face death? Well, the first thing I want us to notice is this, that actually this little piece of land becomes very significant in the book of Genesis. So just flick forward to chapter 25, which we read, to Abraham's own death. And we find verse 9, his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite. So Abraham is buried in exactly the same place. And then, you don't need to turn to it, but in chapter 35, we find that Isaac is buried there. And then let me read to you chapter 49, verses 29 to 31 of Genesis, because there we're heading towards the death of Jacob, where Jacob gives instructions to his sons. I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre in Canaan, which Abraham bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. And there I buried Leah. And so you have Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, they're all buried in this same place. And finally, in Genesis, we have Joseph. Now, Joseph is a bit of a problem because actually Joseph dies in Egypt, far away from Ephron's field. And yet, interestingly, at least I think is interesting, at the end of Genesis, Joseph, before he dies, gives an instruction. Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid. God's going to rescue you from this land of Egypt. And what must you do then? Then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph is saying, I'm about to die. I'm not going to be buried in the promised land immediately myself, but rather you're to keep hold of my bones so that when you guys go into the promised land, you will take my bones with you. And sure enough, that's what happens in the book of Joshua. Right at the end of Joshua, and to be honest, unless you knew the background in Genesis, you'd wonder why on earth this is here. But you find at the end of Joshua, Joshua 24, and Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the tract of land that Jacob bought, and so on. And so Joseph isn't actually buried in the same cave, but significantly, he is buried in the promised land. And so all this generation of people, when they die, are buried in the promised land, either because of Abraham negotiating for the land, or because Joseph gave this instruction to his descendants. Now, why on earth does this matter? I mean, who cares where you're buried? If you're dead, you're dead, aren't you? Well, Hebrews 11 says that it matters a great deal. Hebrews 11 says that Joseph's instructions about the bones were a great act of faith. And I think by implication, you could say that Abraham's desire to negotiate for Sarah to be buried in the promised land was an act of faith as well. Because what they're saying is this. They're saying, God is going to give us this land. He hasn't done it yet, but he will do. And it matters that beyond death, we're in the land that God gave. That's the thing. It matters that beyond death, we're in the land that God will give. And of course it matters because it's more than just physical land. When Abraham dies, he's spoken of being gathered to his people. And there's just a hint of him being reunited with loved ones. It's not massively explicit, but it does hint that there's more than just burial for Abraham. But of course, in Hebrews 11, that sort of implicit thing in Genesis becomes absolutely explicit, where Hebrews 11 says that Abraham is longing for a better country, a heavenly country, a country to which the promised land is just pointing, a heavenly country. In the end, a land that will come down from heaven as part of a whole new creation. You see, Genesis 23 tells us that it matters that Sarah, as it were, dies into the promised land, into the land that God will give. And Hebrews tells us that is but a picture of a heavenly land, a heavenly country. And here's the point of all those land negotiations. Here's the point. It matters that we die into the heavenly land. It matters that we die into the land which the promised land is just a picture of. That really matters. You see, if you think about it, Abraham's position is rather similar to ours. You know, did his people have possession of the land at that point? You know, could he, as it were, see the Israelites in possession of the land? No, he couldn't see that. All he had, if you like, were the promises of God who had proved faithful. And of course, sure enough, he was right. It would take 500 years, but in the end, they would take that land. And I want to say we're in exactly the same position. Can we see the heavenly lands that we die into? No, we can't see that at the moment. But if you like, just like Abraham, we are called to die by faith. We're called to die trusting God's promises. To die trusting that there is a heavenly land for those who know Jesus Christ. That's the call. It mattered where they died into. It matters where we die into. I want to say that is the position when we lose Christian loved ones. Maybe it's a parent. Maybe like Abraham, it's a spouse we've lost. And like Abraham did with Sarah, we mourn and we grieve. But I want to say that once we've mourned and we grieve, then, like Abraham, we also say that what matters is that they're now in the promised land. They're now in the land God has promised to give. They're in the heavenly country now. That's how we face death, knowing that there is a land that God has promised. And that's how we're to die. We face death saying, this is just the door into the land that God has promised, an unseen but heavenly land. Now, it's actually been the mark of Christians down the centuries. One of the reasons that the Christian church grew in the early years was that Christians died well. They were being martyred. But as they were being martyred, they demonstrated a peace that their martyrdom was simply the passage to a heavenly country. And they died well. and that struck people who were fearful of their own deaths. Martin Luther, the great reformer, he actually died peacefully, which in his life was slightly astonishing, really. But Luther was somebody who died well. His last words were Psalm 68, verse 20. Our God is a God who saves. From the sovereign Lord comes escape from death. That's our hope. Death cannot hold us. There is a promised land. There is a heavenly country. Oh, I love in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Mr. Despondency. It's a great name, that, isn't it? Mr. Despondency. Here are his last words as he approaches death. Farewell night, welcome day. That's how he faces death. There's a heavenly country beyond. Well, here's the question. How do we die into the promised land like that? How do we die well? I want to suggest we need to reflect much on the promises of God. That's what Abraham seems to do. In this section, Genesis 3 to 25, you find this reference to God keeping his promises. We saw that particularly last week, the way in which Abraham went to or sent his servant to find Isaac a wife, knowing that God had promised this land to his offspring. I know that sometimes life can get tough, perhaps particularly as we get older, perhaps particularly as we face bereavement and so on. But the great cry of this section is this: remember, we have a promise. And when 5 months to live turns to 4 months to live, you have a promise. There is a heavenly land. We're simply dying into it. But if the first point is about dying into a promised land, here's the second point. It's leaving a legacy. Leaving a legacy. You know, I mentioned earlier that there is a little bit of a blip. And you find that blip at the beginning of Genesis 25. Genesis 25, verse 1, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. Now, at one level, this seems fair enough, doesn't it? Sarah has died. Why shouldn't Abraham remarry? And it seems, despite the fact that he was very old at this point, they had lots of children. There were 6 of them with impossible names referred to in verse 2. The problem is, I don't actually think that's what's going on in this passage. Because you see in verse 6 that you have reference to concubines and to the sons of his concubines. A concubine is somebody you sleep with in addition to your wife, an extra wife, as it were. And it's worth noticing that in this section it's plural. As it were, it's not just, frankly, a reference to Hagar and Ishmael. There are more concubines than that. And actually, 1 Chronicles 1:32 refers to Keturah as a concubine. In other words, it's almost certainly the case that Sarah is still alive when Abraham gets together with Keturah and these other children are produced. Now, what might surprise us is the apparent lack of condemnation in the text. It's actually Tim Keller who makes a point about this. He says that this tendency, if you like, to have more than one wife is rarely specifically condemned in the Old Testament. Rather, the point is made through this. All the relationships with concubines end up being an absolute disaster. They end up simply producing family feuding and tension. And let's be honest, various of Abraham's descendants with impossible names end up being a real pain in the neck for Israel during their history. And that's more than the fact that they had to pronounce them. They end up being a source of conflict, war, and so on. And yet I suppose the other point you'd simply want to make is this: God really is a God of grace. As you see Abraham with the mistake, at least you could put it like that, with Hagar leading to Ishmael. If I'm right, and this is another mistake with Keturah, well, you end up saying, yep, this is still the family God has chosen. Perhaps you'd think, why on earth would God choose a family like that? But then again, I sometimes ask myself the question, why on earth would God choose me? He really is a God of grace who chooses his people not based on their performance and their achievements. But the thing I do want us to notice tonight is actually something Abraham does get right here. And he gets something right in advance of his death. It comes up in verses 5 and 6. Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac. But while he was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. You know, Abraham provides for the children of his concubines, for those like Ishmael. That was the right thing to do. After all, he was responsible for them. But in terms of his legacy, he leaves everything to Isaac. And that is right as well. You see, in Genesis 17, Ishmael has been born. Isaac doesn't exist yet. And Abraham says to God, if only Ishmael could live under your blessing. If only we didn't have to wait for this heir. If only Ishmael could live under your blessing. And God says, no. Isaac, the fruit of your relationship with Sarah, Isaac will be born. And my covenant is with him. And if you like, Abraham leaving all that he has to Isaac is a reflection of what God has said. God has said the future is with Isaac. And if you like, Abraham is playing his part in keeping God's promises by ensuring that all God has blessed him with follows through to Isaac. Abraham is making a decision here in line with God's promises. And that's what he does shortly before he dies. He makes sure that his legacy goes to the right place. It goes to Isaac, the one whom God has promised to bless. That was the legacy Abraham left behind, the decision that he makes shortly before he dies. And I want to say that there is a calling that comes to us. The reality of death is this: what legacy will we leave behind? I don't mean particularly in terms of our will at this point. I simply means in terms of the impact that we have. You see, if you notice, Abraham uses his last few years to further the promises of God, both by finding a wife for Isaac in chapter 24, and then by leaving his possessions to Isaac in chapter 25. He is living the last few years in the light of God's promises before he dies. And actually, the question comes to us, what about us? Can we leave a legacy behind that furthers the promises of God? Leave a legacy behind that, like Abraham, furthers God's promises. I've mentioned this before, I think, but I remember my grandmother's funeral. My grandmother was a fine Christian lady, but actually in a very, very quiet way. Just humble, servant-hearted. She wasn't a sort of big figure in the church or anything. And I don't forget my dad actually talking at her funeral and saying that whilst they'd been sort of clearing the house, they'd found her checkbook. And of course, it was the days before online transfers, so he had a checkbook with all the sort of stubs filled in. And my dad just recorded his emotions as he looked through the checkbook and check after check after check after check funding different parts of World Mission. And he remembers saying at the funeral, that's the legacy she's left. The legacy she has left is just the spread of the gospel in different parts of the world. Because she used her last few years saying, how can I further the promises of God? How can I leave that sort of legacy? Others I know using their last few years to pray for the ongoing impact of the gospel. Others, despite ongoing sort of old age, that were still seeking to bless a younger generation and so on, leaving a legacy behind, even in their last few years. In his book, Don't Waste Your Life, John Piper speaks about a tragedy. He said he'd read about a tragedy, a couple who'd retired, basically in order to travel the world collecting shells and rocks. And he says, what a tragedy. Their last few years before meeting the Lord, and all they've got to show for it are a few shells. Isn't that a tragedy? It's not what Abraham would do. His last few years are leaving behind what will last. Leaving stuff behind for Isaac, the one who will inherit God's blessing. Leaving behind what will last. Can I say, I'm hugely thankful for, I think senior friends is the last phrase I was told to use in this context. Hugely grateful for our senior friends in this place, because all of you, as far as I can tell, are still working for a legacy that lasts. And I want to say simply, keep going. Use your last years to continue to reflect the priorities and the promises of God. And for those like me, a little bit younger than our senior friends, learn from them. Learn from the example of seeing those now retired who are still wanting to live for God. And learn what it means to leave a legacy behind. How do you approach death? Well, you realize that for the Christian, death is dying into the promised land. How do you approach death? Well, use the remaining years to leave a legacy that lasts. And then lastly, let's look at the reason you can be sure. Because here's the question, how can you know all this? How can you know we die into the heavenly promised land? Why is it worth working for a legacy that lasts? And the answer is this: because God keeps his promises after you die. God keeps his promises after you die. That's actually what happens in verse 11. It's just a little phrase, Genesis 25, verse 11. After Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac. You see, God had promised, I'm going to bless you, Abraham, and I'm going to bless your descendants. And so he does. He blesses Isaac after Abraham has gone. Actually, we're not going to look at it in depth, but verses 12 to 18 actually show that God keeps his promises to Ishmael as well. In Genesis 17, God says that 12 tribes, 12 rulers will come from Ishmael. And if you look at verse 16, they do. After Abraham dies, God keeps his promises. I know for some people that can be a fear. You know, after I've gone, what will happen? What will happen to family, friends, and so on? I simply want to say this: after I've gone, God will keep his promises. He always has done. He always will. You see, God keeps his promises all the way through time. Let me just track one Genesis promise that we've returned to frequently in this series. You see, God says to Abraham, through you, all peoples on earth will be blessed. Through you, all nations, all peoples on earth will be blessed. And let's just move forward a bit, because later we see Isaiah making a great promise to all peoples. It says this, Isaiah 25, 6. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats, and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. As you get this promise to all peoples, God is going to bless all nations through the son of Abraham. And then in Isaiah, you've got this great promise that one day there's going to be a great banquet for all nations, a great banquet for all peoples, and death will be destroyed forever. And how are those promises fulfilled? The promise to Abraham, all nations will be blessed. The promise of Isaiah, there'll be a banquet for all peoples, the end of death for all peoples. How are those promises met? Well, they're met through the son of Abraham. The son of Abraham who knows what it's like to face imminent death, who prepares for that imminent death by taking bread and wine, a body broken, blood poured out. He knows he is going to die. But by his death and resurrection, he fulfills that Isaiah promise. He does destroy death for all peoples. And you see, on that night, he says, remember me. But he also says something else. I tell you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. And so you see the Genesis promise, all peoples are going to be blessed. The Isaiah promise, all peoples are going to be blessed through a great banquet in the end of death. And Jesus saying, I'm going to die, and the result is one day I'm going to eat at the great banquet. And all peoples, all nations are going to be there. Do you see? That's the great promise that God keeps all the way through Scripture. That's why we can die safely. That's why we can know we die into the promised land, because God keeps his promises. That's why actually we can work for a legacy that lasts, because we know it will last, because God keeps his promises. And we live in the light of those promises, and we die in the light of those promises. And so the Christian says, farewell night, welcome day. And my plea is simply this. I'm aware that we've focused on death quite a lot this evening, but my plea is simply this. Keep reflecting much on the promises of God. Because all of us are dying. Because we lose people who die. Keep reflecting on the promises of God. Reflect on the promise of the son of Abraham. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. Or as you think about working for a legacy that lasts, remember what the Apostle Paul says after his great chapter on the resurrection of the dead. He says, always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. Why? Because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Die confidently. leave a legacy that lasts. Why? Because God will keep his promises regarding death. There is a heavenly land we die into. And that's why the Christian sings that on that day when my strength is failing, the end draws near and my time has come, still my soul will sing your praise unending, 10,000 years and then forevermore. And that's why the Christian sings, dark, dark hath been the midnight, but day spring is at hand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. The Christian dies confidently. Why? Because we're heading to the promised land. Let's pray together.